Good evening. Thank you for coming. I'm Mark Crispin Miller. This is First Tuesdays for April. Our aim here is to provide a forum for authors whose books have either been unfairly ignored or unfairly attacked, books that are important enough to merit as much attention as we can give them. And that's certainly the case with the book that we'll be hearing about tonight. Let me preface this by saying that today there's a very important election taking place in Wisconsin for a Supreme Court seat. It's regarded as has a tremendous amount of symbolic importance because if the Republicans win this one, it is felt this is a victory for Scott Walker and the union-busting movement. If it's a victory for the Democrats, then supposedly this will mean a repudiation of that movement, which is funded by the Koch brothers and other billionaires. The problem with this whole scenario and with that election and with all of our elections is that we actually cannot any longer know if the official winner of any given race is actually the winner. And this has to do with a concerted drive by the right in America to use every means available to game the election system. Now, there's a myth that they have propagated in order to do their thing, and that myth is that the Democrats habitually engage in massive voter fraud. This is a very old myth, goes back to the 19th century, goes back to the days when people stuffed ballots and so on, which you can't actually do anymore, but the myth dies hard. And on the basis of that myth, widespread Democratic voter fraud, the right has succeeded in destroying, for example, ACORN, the Poor People's Organization that was extremely successful at getting out the vote, among other things. Well, on the basis of this myth, ACORN was taken down, and even as we speak, there's a lot of legislation pending in at least half the states, I think it is, to require voter IDs, sometimes birth certificates, all kinds of onerous neo-Jim Crow requirements, the aim of which is to shrink the pool of eligible voters to the left as much as possible. Okay. Now, what we need is a learned and hard-hitting refutation of this idea, and we have that in the book The Myth of Voter Fraud by Lori Menitti, teaches at Barnard College. She has taken a very careful look at the reality out there to determine whether or not voter fraud is and has been widespread among voters of color and the poor and so on. I think it's extremely important that we pay attention to her and to study her research and make people aware of the fact that this is a myth. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Lori Menitti.
Well, thank you very much for coming out this evening. This book actually took, I don't know, anywhere from 5 to 7 years to research. And so it is based on a lot of incredibly hard research. I mean, this isn't the kind of research that takes you to foreign countries and puts you in harm's way. But I started out with the simple question about how much voter fraud there actually was, because this argument that Mark was alluding to is used constantly. You can look in the history of the expansion of voting rights in the United States, and at every turn, every single turn, the challenge is to overcome the claim that to make it just a little bit easier to vote for people, is to open up the floodgates for all the criminals in the United States to cast ballots more than once. So we wanted to know, just answer a simple question, was this actually a problem? And it turns out that political scientists haven't studied this much at all. There's really there was no good academic research out there to answer the question. And I came at this in a somewhat naive way. I thought, well, this wouldn't be that hard to figure out because I know a lot about election data and social science data and political data and data sets and how they're kept and so forth. And I thought, well, this won't take me very long. But it actually turned out to be quite difficult to try to just document whether or not there was a problem. So, you know, I think I say here in this book, of course, we all believe that democracy demands electoral integrity, and that one fraudulent vote is one too many. I don't say in this book this never happens. I say it rarely happens. And, you know, this is based on trying to collect statistics from every attorney general in the United States, every Secretary of State in the United States. I sent letters to every single county district attorney in the United States. I used open record laws. I used Freedom of Information Act requests for the federal government because this whole current kind of movement to push photo ID laws is really a party trick. And it got some impetus with the Bush Justice Department. When the Bush Justice Department launched right after the 2000 election, by the spring of 2001, had put together a program called the Ballot Access and Voting Integrity Initiative at the Justice Department. And actually, that name, the Ballot Access and Voting Integrity Initiative, was the name of a program that the Reagan Justice Department ran in the 1980s when they went after black civil rights activists in Alabama and other parts of the South. And it was a similar kind of intimidation campaign, charging these civil rights activists, some of whom had worked with Martin Luther King and were engaged in training rural people on how to use absentee ballots, charge them with criminal kinds of fraud. And again, that they weren't convicted. This was a kind of initiative that was launched by the Reagan Justice Department, same name. So Bush II comes in, uses the old name, puts it together. What does it consist of? It consists of pulling all the US attorneys into the program. They had to designate a district representative. They pulled them all to Washington. They went through a training. It was supposed to be looking for both fraud and voter intimidation, which is more what the Justice Department has done in the past in terms of implementing civil rights laws and the voting rights laws, is to look for voter intimidation and to protect vulnerable voters from that kind of activity. So this was sort of launched as a campaign that would do both, so sort of neutral. It had nothing to do with looking at voter intimidation. It was all about looking for voter fraud, and whether they were naive about this as I was, must be out there. You hear about it so much, must be out there. That, you know, in the end, I looked at this program, and in the first 3 years of the program, they had 95 indictments, which actually isn't a lot. Of the 95 indictments, half of them really weren't, they weren't indicting voters. They were indicting either election officials or other people, and they were sort of lumping it all together and trying to come up with numbers every 3 months of how many indictments and so forth. And in the end, they convicted 26 voters. 20 of them were people who had felony convictions and had voted, not realizing, in many cases, that in fact they weren't eligible to vote because they might have still been under probation in the states they were living in. You couldn't do that. I actually went out to Milwaukee to interview a guy who had been indicted but not convicted. And the reason he wasn't convicted is because about a week before his case was going to go to trial, he was represented by sort of legal services people in the Federal Defenders Program in Milwaukee. His lawyer discovered that he had actually used an ID card to register to vote, because in Wisconsin, you can register on Election Day. And because he had been in prison, he was living at his aunt's house in transition. He was a very low-income guy. He had a high school diploma. He had voted, he said, every election from the time he was 18. He was probably in his mid-40s. But because he'd been in jail and then he had come out, he didn't have a place to live, his aunt came back on Election Day. She said, Derek, you have to come. You have to vote. It's important to vote. And he thought, well, I don't have any ID. What ID should I use? And he remembered that he had his prison ID card. And it had his picture on it. It had his name. And, he brought a letter from his probation officer that showed his address. And he went to the school, and he presented this. He said, I am so-and-so. Here's my ID card. Here's my parole letter showing where I live at my aunt's house. They registered him to vote, and they wrote that the form of ID he presented was a state ID card, prison ID card. So this guy was caught up in part of the investigation in Milwaukee by one of the Bush Department, Justice Department appointees there, who was a U.S. attorney. They were running this pilot program in Milwaukee to catch people in this man's position as an ex-felon. And as one of the people involved in this program told another interviewer, what they were trying to do in picking up people like this was to see, quote, what works with juries on cases like this. They wanted to prosecute people like him. Use your tax dollars to go after this guy who didn't do anything wrong. This is all in talking about some of the research that I did. It was actually quite surprising to me how difficult it was to try to collect this information. And I can really say I went at this in a neutral position. I probably thought there was a lot. I didn't think it would be that hard to find it. And the more I tried and the more I looked, the more I became convinced that this just doesn't happen. This just doesn't happen. That, political scientists know this. It's hard to get people to vote once, let alone twice. So you need a conspiracy, right, to really kind of have an impact through fraud. You need a conspiracy. Once you have a conspiracy, you've got a lot of points of access for law enforcement. And in fact, in the past, the federal government, when it has prosecuted election fraud, and at the time I was doing this research, the Justice Department was involved in breaking up some vote buying schemes in rural Kentucky and West Virginia that were, somewhat of a way of life there. But it has to do with exploitation of poor people and conspiracies. I mean, the ringleader in that case, one of those cases, was a millionaire coal mine owner, coal mine operator. When there's conspiracies, the government has prosecuted them. Government can find it. They can prosecute it. When it's an individual who goes to vote not understanding the rules because they're not explained to them, this is not the kind of problem that the governor of Texas should address as an emergency issue, which he has done this year, putting emergency legislation through in Texas to try to bring more stringent voter ID rules to Texas. I mean, there is this momentum and urgency in the states right now, and Mark's absolutely right. At least probably half the states have pushed through where you have Republican Party control, usually of the entire government there, so they can ram these things through. They have been trying to do this now for a number of years, and have failed where they've had governors who won't sign the bills and so forth. But where you have this sort of unified control, these things are going through, as they recently did in Ohio. So You know, I, as I said, I sort of first started out trying to document it, and it was this incredibly difficult thing to do. I did the best I could to simply say, shouldn't there be an imprint? If you're saying there's some kind of criminal behavior going on, shouldn't there be an imprint? People will say to me, well, but it's fraud. It's designed not to be detected. I say, well, isn't all crime designed not to be detected? You know, and we find it. And, you know, to make that point, I looked up, I had this, one of the data sets that I was able to access was a database of all of the federal indictments brought in district court level, in the appellate court level, all federal indictments. And this is, you know, these are somewhere close to 200,000 indictments a year brought by the federal government. And I looked through all of that and tried to find anybody being indicted for anything related to some kind of election fraud. And so, for example, in fiscal year 2005, looking at this data, there were 60 indictments. These were just indictments of people who there was something to do with elections. Now, most of these indictments, because I then had to go and look up all of the indictments, most of them were for campaign finance violations by politicians. They're coded in this data set as elections. So keep that in mind, but still we're talking 60 indictments, not convictions, indictments. How does that compare to other kinds of fraud that might be committed? Well, there were 1,980 indictments for Social Security fraud. There were 6,658 indictments for false claims, simply making false claims. There were 3,161 indictments for counterfeiting. There were 6,929 indictments for postal, internet, and wire fraud. So fraud can be detected, crime can be detected. The federal government, law enforcement officials have ways of doing it. And with respect to elections, that's the whole point of the registration system, is to prevent fraud. That's why you register beforehand. That's where registration comes from. The whole history of imposing registration laws was at the time claimed to be an anti-fraud measure as well. So that's why we have that, so that people are identified beforehand, and then states have lots of different rules about how you identify yourself at the polls. But no system is perfect. Like I said, no, I don't say it never happens, and there isn't, you know, there aren't sort of malevolent people out there or people who want to play games and tricks and things like that. I mean, there's so many cases of, you know, people registering their poodle, people, you know, seeing if they can scam the system and then using that and saying, oh, it's easy, you know, I could register my poodle. It's like, well, did your poodle vote? I mean, that's what we want to know. And how did he vote? It's true. A lot of these cases, it turns out that people who have been caught have voted for Republicans. Like, for example, in the 2004 governor's race in Washington, that was a very hotly, you know, closely contested race. It went through a couple recounts. And actually, fraud allegations didn't emerge right away in that case. They came out later when they realized they really were going to lose, that this judge, you know, that the Republicans had kind of helped pick, not that they helped pick him, but they were very happy with him when he got assigned the case. They thought they were going to win that case. And, you know, the Democrats went out and they found people who had received absentee ballots, who had felony records, and had sent them in because they thought, you're sending me a ballot, you must want me to send it back in. You know, if I'm not eligible to vote, why are you sending me a ballot? And they were able to find a number of people who admitted basically in affidavits that they had voted for Republicans. Even though, so actually the final vote tally in that case was reduced by 4 because the judge said, well, there actually were 4 fraudulent voters here. You know, fraudulent meaning they had violated the rules about who can vote based on that the felony conviction issue. So the book starts that way, and then I kept scratching my head about how to connect what I was hearing about fraud rampant, and now, you know, the attack on Acorn begins. And it begins when Acorn in Florida decides that they are going to try to go through the election process to get to raise the minimum wage, because they can't get it through the state legislature, because legislature is controlled by the Republicans. So they run a big campaign, they register people, and they actually win in Florida. They get it on the ballot, and the voters vote for it, enthusiastically vote to raise the minimum wage in Florida. That was the beginning of the end for them. You don't do that. You make people very mad when you do that. So that sort of initiated trying to figure out if they could make Acorn a kind of boogeyman in this voter fraud scandal, basically. So, you know, I moved from there to thinking about how propaganda works in American politics, and because I come to the conclusion, really, that there just simply is no evidence that this is happening at the level, individual voter level. And we have to understand the myth of voter fraud as a kind of propaganda, and how does that work? And I do that, and right in the first chapter, I give a couple of examples of that. And I look, for example, at John Fund's claims. Early in 2004, he wrote a book called Stealing Elections. And he claimed that, in fact, some of the 9/11 hijackers, he says, were actually able to register to vote in either Virginia or Florida while they made their deadly preparations for 9/11. So this is explosive, right? He said that his source was Michael Chertoff, who at the time was the head of the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department. I asked John Fund for his evidence. I asked him for his notes from that meeting, couldn't provide any of it. He wanted to get together for lunch, and I thought, well, now I would like to see the evidence of this claim. That was the only source that he provided. And this is the way it works. A kind of spurious allegation is made, and then the allegation is repeated over and over and over and over again. And when it's repeated, it becomes news. And once it becomes news, it becomes evidence for something else. It may be evidence used in a lawsuit. One of the things, again, the Republicans did through this period was they would produce booklets of news stories that they had actually generated that were sort of stories about allegations. And they would use that and they would say, this is the evidence. And they would take it to the Justice Department. And the whole U.S. attorney scandal, a number of those men and one woman were caught up in this. They had not proceeded and tried to prosecute or find or investigate voter fraud strenuously enough. And part of this was, we gave them the evidence. The evidence actually was what we kind of produced. So it's sort of, this is a little bit about the propaganda technique and tactic. So in this case with the 9/11 hijackers, Senator Kit Bond from Missouri repeats this actually on the floor of the U.S. Senate. A number of members of the House also repeat Fund's allegations. So now it's in the congressional record and you can use it. You can say, well, here's the evidence. You know, a senator, House members have said this. Fund then goes on to elaborate this on the Lou Dobbs program on TV. And he says, Lou Dobbs asks him, he says, yeah, you know, I think actually some of them were registered. He slipped up a little bit. First he said they might have been registered. Then he said they were registered. And the repetition of this argument becomes a kind of code. It's a kind of communication with a constituency. And in this case, the constituency here were those who think that the registration laws are too loose. And they have been criticizing the National Voter Registration Act since it was passed in 1993. They have said that you shouldn't be allowed to register by mail. I don't know what you're supposed to do, fingerprint maybe, blue ink, I don't know. There's been this like obsession with this law and how it allows people to register by mail. And so this was code to them. This was a communication to them. Why? Because what Fund is referring to is that you're allowed to register to vote by going to the DMV. So when he said that some of them, we all knew that some of them had obtained driver's license which is not illegal for a green card holder, but state IDs. And in fact, there was some forgeries and so forth among this group of people in obtaining those IDs. But the code is they went to the DMV. We know they did because we have the license evidence, and they may have been able to register to vote. So, you know, I had a research assistant work an entire summer trying to figure out if this was correct. And in the end, I had, you know, the election officials in Florida, they ran the names of every one of the hijackers and every known alias of the hijackers this way and that way through their database. They could not find any evidence of this. And I actually had an FBI public affairs person who said that he spoke to, quote, someone actively involved in investigating this allegation, and he said the hijackers were not registered to vote in either state. So they weren't registered to vote. But this was already out there. And, you know, I looked at this. Spencer Overton, who's a law professor, looked at this particular allegation. It's very interesting. John Fund took this out of his book when he republished it in time for the 2006 election. One other example of this propaganda kind of technique, how does it work? That's the question. How does it work? Well, you start with these spurious, exaggerated, distorted, unsupported allegations, and you offer them as fact. And the example here is an organization called the American Voting Rights, ACVR, which was launched in 2005. It existed for just under 2 years. It was one of these sort of organizations where you can't learn about who's funding them because of its tax status. One of the founders of it was a St. Louis attorney and a GOP operative named Mark Thor Hearn, and he testified at a field hearing in Ohio after the 2004 election. He testified about voting problems there, and he said that, you know, in Ohio, the NAACP was paying people with crack cocaine to get them to register to vote. He actually said this in a congressional hearing, put it in, you know, put it on paper, made it part of a lawsuit. And, you know, within 6 months of this organization sort of appearing, and it was created by political operatives, within 6 months, they came out with a report that they said was the most comprehensive and authoritative review of the facts surrounding allegations of vote fraud, intimidation, and suppression made during the 2004 presidential election. As I say in the book, analysis of the claims here show it to be little more than a pile of poorly scrutinized newspaper articles sensationalizing election shenanigans allegedly instigated in all but two instances by Democrats. And I went through every one of the allegations in this report, every single one of these allegations. It took me a very long time to track down everything, and I found the same thing. I found these are not actual cases of fraud. These were cases of people saying, I think somebody may have committed fraud. And this becomes a news story. The news story gets transformed into evidence. There's a direct action to do this. And then the evidence gets spread around. And that becomes, you know, what the basis for many journalists were covering in those years. So the code here that the ACVR and their allies were using was about Democrats. Democrats, you know, are racial minorities, criminal, low-income people, Democrats. It used to be liberals, now it's, you know, Democrats for them. And this, as I say, was sort of the basis for part of this full-blown assault on Acorn, because Acorn could become visible to the public. They didn't have to say, we think too many minority low-income people are voting. They could just say Acorn, and, you know, Acorn doesn't exist anymore. And yet, I keep up on a lot of this. People are still talking about Acorn. I mean, I've been attacked because one of the reports I did was for Project Vote, where I am now working as a research director for Project Vote, and Project Vote had a relationship with Acorn. In terms of designing voter registration campaigns for them as well. So, you know, people go through, they figure all this out, and they say, oh, no wonder, you know, Acorn, it's a good thing it died, it was committing all that fraud. And the facts are that there were very few sort of convictions. There were people who had forged registration applications and so forth, those people were fired by Acorn. And in many cases, Acorn found the fraud and handed it to the law enforcement officials and, you know, didn't get any credit for that. So, you know, so I think, why does this myth persist? That's the question. When the evidence is so clear that this is not the problem, and of course it persists because it serves powerful people, it's useful to powerful people, they have the means to keep it alive, and also because, you know, it's a myth, it's a parable that touches on something, you know, deep in our culture, in our history, in our society that we are not really fully done with about inequality here in the United States. So that's kind of, you know, the book overall traces through that little bit of a journey there. I think that, you know, I think actually the problem now more is the problem of propaganda, which I'm so pleased to be invited by Mark Crispin Miller to speak here, because he actually knows something about propaganda, and it's not something that we have studied academics in any really serious way and really fully understand. And I think in the new internet age, we really need to do that, because the internet has created this parallel reality that people think is real, and in fact, there are a lot of illusions there. So I want to thank Mark very much, and thank the bookstore here for inviting me to come and tell you about this book. Thanks.
Make some points and have you respond. One reason why this continues that you did not mention is that nobody within the establishment ever stands up and repudiates, you know, refutes this. You mentioned John Fund, okay? Let's talk about John Fund for a minute. Who is John Fund? John Fund is a propagandist. John Fund is on the Wall Street Journal editorial board, and he got his start working for Evans and Novak. He floated the story in the 90s that Sidney Blumenthal, the big Clinton aide, was beating up his wife, right? Which it was ironic because, in fact, Fund was beating up his girlfriend, but I won't stoop to that. At any rate, this is what Fund does. He does propaganda. His book Stealing Elections is a joke, right? If you look at who actually subsidized the book, the people he thanks, you know, it's the Heritage Foundation and Hoover and all these outfits. It purports to be an even-handed treatment of the issue, but it's a propaganda grenade is what it is. Now John Fund gets to go on Lou Dobbs. John Fund is often asked to weigh in on this issue by the mainstream media, okay? Can anyone tell me the name of a pro-Democratic Party operative who is out there giving him the lie? Mm. This is a rhetorical question. Mm-hmm. There is nobody like that, okay? Nobody in the Democratic Party establishment and nobody in the media ever stands up and tells the truth about what's going on here. Okay. In fact, you get somebody like Donna Brazile, the Democratic Party, who actually has ridiculed those voters, those African-American voters who seem to think that there's election fraud in places like Ohio. She's Democratic Party operative, right? And that's her position? Okay. Now, I don't really pretend to understand this, but I have some ideas, but they're too crazy and frightening to share them in public. But the fact of the matter is, you got one side making this argument, and it resonates endlessly, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you this. What was the pub date of your book?
June 2010.
And tell us about the review attention you've gotten for it.
Very little.
Well, any?
Well, Choice wrote a nice review, yeah,
Choice,
which
okay.
I think is the organization that writes reviews of books mainly for kind of recommending whether libraries should buy them or not. It's not exactly, you know.
What about Publishers Weekly?
Nope, I don't think so.
No.
No, very
Did
little.
Copies go to the New York Times Book Review?
I know, you know, it's published by Cornell University Press, which means as an academic publisher, it's put through a somewhat pretty rigorous vetting process. I mean, there's a whole process of reviewing the manuscript before they even agree. That's a kind of, you know, academic peer-reviewed blind review process. Through that, there were good reviews from some academics, you know, who were able to read the manuscript before it was published. But I know that Cornell did you know, what they did to try to market the book to both a more popular audience as well as academic journals. I mean, I guess I wouldn't be too surprised about no reviews yet in academic journals, because they're just notoriously slow.
I know,
but in terms of popular.
I wish you well on
thank
that
you.
Front, but we're talking about a book of
yeah.
tremendous civic importance, right? So I'm interested in knowing
yeah.
why the mainstream press hasn't reviewed it, and where's the review in The Nation?
Hmm.
Okay.
I'll have to call them.
Well, see, I mean, the issue is
yeah.
is not, it is off the radar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is regarded as a crackpot issue, and this is beyond tragic. This is extremely dangerous,
yeah.
you know, because everybody, you know, bows and does this sort of ritual salute to the memory of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, right? Everybody does this sort of official thing where they, oh yeah, it was a great thing, wonderful. It's the way they talk about Watergate. They give it a laurel and hearty handshake,
right.
you know. But let's recall that movement was fundamentally about voting rights,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Now that we have an election system that is completely gamed by the right so that people cannot vote, I don't hear anybody talking about it, right?
Yeah, no,
except
it's true.
You and a few people.
Yeah, and you.
That's really sad. Guy.
So can we draw a distinction between your definition of fraud and the work that Marx come up with, where he can document tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of votes that are just switched from one part to the other or wiped out?
Should I repeat that for the...
Yeah.
Guy asks you to make a mm-hmm. distinction between vote suppression,
mm-hmm.
because you're talking about vote suppression, things like requiring photo ID laws and so on. Vote suppression on the one hand and election fraud on the other, election fraud being primarily the use of computerized voting systems to erase votes imperceptibly and or add ghost votes to the other side. Okay, so
yes, I mean that's a good question, and I do make that distinction, you know, somewhat ad nauseum in the book about defining what fraud is, and then sort of in a, you know, criminal legal way what fraud is, and then who is perpetrating it. I say, you know, when you can't just talk about fraud. Because it's interesting, you say fraud, and I guess sort of the left, some small part of it, is thinking about what Mark is talking about, and a big part of the right is thinking about what I'm writing about. So they're not even like talking to each other in that sense, or they're not sort of even understanding that we're talking about fundamentally different kinds of problems in the electoral system. One, continuing a tradition of trying to suppress votes, especially among poor people and minorities, and the other, a kind of corruption of the process that has been around for a long time, actually, and not distinguishing who is committing the fraud. That's really the fundamental difference in the end, I think. But at the same time, another way they're related is this myth of voter fraud is part of the distraction about the other kinds of problems and the scale of the other kinds of problems, because you don't even have to believe that this is intentional, the votes that are not counted or perhaps switched. You don't have to believe that there's anything intentional or about that. It's a fact that there are millions of votes that are, quote, lost in federal elections because they can't, you know, they get people, they don't sign the right place, the registration records aren't accurate. It's not the fault of the voter. I mean, this is now sort of standard understanding. Out of the 2000 election, MIT teamed up with Caltech, and they did a very sort of rigorous trying to look at problems in the in election administration. And they concluded, you know, 3 million, 4 million votes in that election alone were what they called lost. So they weren't assigning blame, they weren't assigning intentionality, they weren't assigning partisan, you know, issues behind it. They just were, evaporated. So, you know, how come you're not concerned about that? That's a, you can't have integrity in elections if everyone who wants to vote and is eligible to vote can't cast a ballot and have it counted. So I think, you know, a part of the, it's important to think about these two things together. I focused in very maybe narrow way on the voter fraud question because I wanted to really try to establish the basis for what we could say about that, because that was what was in the news, and that's what's used to justify these new rules, which are just scams on the voter, these ID rules. And I didn't even have the energy to kind of do the other kind of examination, but other people have. And again, put them together and think about how it's working together. One is a sort of myth of distraction about what the problem is in the electoral system, and the other goes relatively unexamined in any serious way. Of course, there are computer scientists who've looked at this, or there are people who have looked at the questions about vote switching and computer problems and rigging, basically through computers. But as Mark says, it's not getting attention. It's not getting people's attention.
Well, actually, vote suppression is more acceptable as a subject for public discussion than election fraud. Election fraud is out there with people raising questions about 9/11.
Yeah, it's like the crazy uncle. Like, you keep him in the closet because he doesn't come out at Thanksgiving. You don't really want him around. We keep him back over there. You're absolutely right about
that.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, it was interesting. Before the 2008 election, for about 6 weeks, a window opened. And I believe it's because the establishment wanted Obama to win. I mean, Wall Street was backing Obama, not McCain. All of a sudden, I was not radioactive anymore. I was on Bill Moyers to talk about this. I was on Amy Goodman's show, and Amy is not that interested in this issue, which is weird. And I was even asked to write a piece for the Wall Street Journal. You know, it was a Saturday, they do this point counterpoint Saturday essay. So they had me write on the problem of election fraud. They had Hans von Spakovsky, who is one of these guys, you know, from the Bush Justice Department, who is like a militant, foaming at the mouth, anti-small-D Democrat. He doesn't want people voting,
right.
Black people especially. And that, you know, I could tell that when I focused more on vote suppression, I could almost hear a purr, you know, but that's okay. Goes back to literacy tests and the poll tax, and that's all familiar. There's a history to it. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
When you start to point out that, you know, a computerized voting system is absolutely insecure and completely hackable, and that ours is owned and run by private companies, okay, with a powerful Republican bias. Companies like ES&S and Diebold Premier are owned and run, were actually started by people with a theocratic agenda. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm not making this up. This is a fact. Okay, even if there weren't volumes and volumes of solid evidence that elections have been stolen that way, even if there weren't, just on its face, how can this be tolerated in a democracy? How can you have a system like that? It's insane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we had a real press, that press would point out that Germany gave up electronic voting and their Supreme Court actually banned it as a human rights violation. The Netherlands tried it. They gave it up. They went back to hand-counted paper ballots. Ireland gave it up and went back to hand-counted paper ballots. Because, again, even if we didn't have solid evidence that elections have been stolen, as we do, okay? It is on its face ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And let me say one last thing here. about the relationship between these propagandists and the problems of election fraud, which are problems of their making, there's a lot of projection here. They talk about, oh, it's imperceptible, it's fraud, it's stealthy, you can't see it, you can't prove it, that's why it's happening. Well, look who's talking, you know? They've actually devised a system of voting in which fraud is imperceptible. I mean, all you need to do is steal just this many votes, mm-hmm. right? Or invent, concoct electronically this many votes in order to win, right?
Right.
That on top of, you know, the distortion of the campaign finance system with Citizens United and other innovations by the right have made democracy something that we enjoy, I think, in name only in this country and not in fact. Do you think mm-hmm. that's an overstatement?
No, I don't. I mean, and it goes, I say that because it does well go beyond the kind of faulty electoral apparatus that we have. I mean, it's all connected in that sense. The policies that we get are connected to the people who get elected.
That's right.
And the
reason your book is so important, and I urge you please to buy a copy, because the author is here. It's an independent bookstore. It's a university press. I mean, cut her a break. She'll she'll sign the book, okay? But it's extremely important that people get the message. I don't expect, you know, Christianist zealots to get the message, because they are the ones who are advantaged by this system. You can't win elections with that agenda, because it's a fringe agenda, right? The Christianist agenda is a fringe agenda. Sarah Palin is a fringe candidate. The Tea Party is a fringe movement, okay? The media disguises or misrepresents the Tea Party as this big movement. It's not big at all. It's quite small. The people who have to get it are the people who are now rebelling and resisting in the Midwest, mm-hmm. okay? I don't hear anybody talking about this. In Ohio, for example, Governor John Kasich, just forced through this grotesque bill, which is a union-busting bill and a ballot-busting bill, all right? It's to make voting even harder. Well, guess what? If you look at the statistics for the 2010 election, which elected John Kasich, okay, there were exit polls there, and we find that there were two people who won in Ohio in 2010 whose vote totals diverge by several percentage points from the exit poll results. We call that a redshift. In other words, Kasich won by something like 3 or 4 more percentage points than the exit polls said he won by. Only him and only his attorney general. That didn't happen with anybody else. Okay? That is compelling evidence that election was fishy. If it happened in Iran, if it happened in Venezuela, our press would be saying, look at those exit poll results, isn't that suspicious? No. If it happens here, they say, well, exit polls are extremely faulty. You never know. They always get it wrong, right? Well, no. See, so what I would like to see is the workers, the public workers in Ohio, focusing on this, you know? Instead of simply calling for recall elections, using the same machinery, which, I mean, we'll see soon what happened in Wisconsin today, this is a very, very serious problem, and it's blind spot I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It could end up killing us. It really could.
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions? Yes?
What's happened to your book and your subject is what happened to Acorn. Your book has been acornized. If you want to come up with something, yeah.
Just answer that.
Yeah, I mean,
the
comment was about the book not getting attention, but also in that sense not having, you know, being acornized by being disappeared, maybe. In that way, and I will say that, you know, when I first started doing the research was probably like around 2001, 2002, and I became appalled at the way that I thought the press in general were covering the allegations, because I was studying, I would do these massive searches of the LexisNexis databases, all the news stories, I'd search in all these different ways, and I read all these stories, and, you know, over and over again, they would do this very sloppy sort of stuff saying, well, They said that there were some suspicious votes, that, you know, the number of people signing in at the polling station didn't exactly match the number of ballots, and that must be fraud. And no investigating, no looking behind that, no thinking about, you know, this is being made, this sort of fight, if you will, it is one-sided. It's one-sided that because there's no opposition, but it's still coming from one party. You know, these politicians, if you have to say that they're at least sort of rational in their interests, they want power, they want to be in power, they want to stay in power, they're very rational about what they do. So why do they think, on one side here in the Republican Party, I mean, why are they doing this? If in fact, I'm saying it actually, you know, doesn't happen, so I'm scratching my head, why are they doing it? You have to keep asking the question about why are they pushing this? Why are they pushing this? Because they believe that it will have an impact, whether it's a close election, especially. I mean, there are House races all over the country at the state level that are won by small numbers of votes, and you just need, you know, enough to take control of state government. And that's what we've seen in the wake of, you know, the Democrats winning in 2006 in the Congress and then winning the presidency, losing a little bit, but winning the presidency. Then we have, you know, Republicans taking control of state government and the consequences of that. I mean, you don't have to have power everywhere to get your agenda through. So, you know, I do think that the press, I started to say that I thought that initially the press, it was just terrible. They would just, it was like they could write a press release, and in many places, because newspapers have been so decimated, especially at the local level, they run the press release like it's a news story, literally. That has gotten a little better. It's gotten a little bit better in the last several years. I mean, and I'm talking like big time, the New York Times, Washington Post reporters. They don't. Not that they write stories of the kind Mark was pointing to, but I know from talking to many reporters that they get it now, and they don't do what they used to do, which is sort of run the press release that came from so and so's campaign as a news story. So that's gotten a little bit better. I don't know. I mean, I spent a lot of time talking to reporters in the past who are covering these issues. I guess just again because nobody else is sort of writing academic books about it, so maybe that carries some weight with some people, so they call and ask me what do I think about this. But it's been, you know, kind of marginal in that way. It's gotten a little better, but it's not really, they haven't busted open the story, I would say, yet.
That's for sure.
Julie.
You know, while the thing's been domestically buried, do you see that now that we're getting a rise in media outside the country? I'm thinking of Bill Moyers thing in Al Jazeera this week where he talked about plutocracy in America, you know, a story which you wouldn't have seen in any American medium probably, but that could have the same effect here as it has had in Tunis and Egypt.
Well, you can always be hopeful, but you know, you think about, for example,
you better repeat what he said.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. So the question.
Well, I put it in this
mic. Oh. Okay. You know, was it just last week there was a Tea Party protest in Washington, and I was told that Fox News like didn't even cover it. There were so few people there. New York Times had a story, and they said 300 people. Okay, so they get a big story. You know, not on the front page, but they got a story about this event where I think Mike Pence was there, who is a member of the Republican leadership in the Congress. And, you know, they're saying, shut it down, because it's about the budget. 300 people. So, you know, I was at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit last summer. There were 15,000 people at that event. It went on for 4 days, 5 days, a week. And there were people from all over. This wasn't just some like far left event. There were church people there, there were community people there, there were peace activists there were labor people there, all kinds of people who come maybe, you know, left of center, progressive, identify with progressive politics were there. 15,000 people. I don't think I saw a single story about that. So I don't know, to answer your question about whether the American media will sort of pick up on these themes of plutocracy, which get play and you know, those words are used by foreign media, even about the United States. I don't know how far it will go, and it's going to take a lot to get attention.
Are you asking if the foreign media is a possible way for us to break the story here?
Yes.
Speaking personally, I've tried to get the foreign press to focus on this. It's tough though because it's not their electoral system. It's not their electorate. You see what I mean? It's been extremely difficult to get people in other countries to show a little solidarity with those few of us who are fighting that issue here, you see, fighting that fight here. I mean, when, was it Obrador who was robbed of the election in Mexico? Calderon, won. Obrador's people just weren't interested in talking to us. I think it was a kind of chauvinism, and they weren't interested in talking to a gringo about this. But this is, this transcends divisions like that.
But if this story is in Al Jazeera, and then you have someone like Gaddafi saying, "Well, look, if you think I'm bad, look at, here's what's happening in America. It's no different. That other people will be using this kind of stuff to like justify the things in their own country, and it will eventually come back into the reflect back into the consciousness here, and it's...
Well, I think Russian television, which we can watch here, Channel 135,
RT,
does actually welcome discussion of this kind of thing, and I suppose that can help, right? But the thing is, why, when we have a sort of left press here, do we have to hope that Al Jazeera will cover this? It's strange, It's very strange. My own experience with this, going back to 2005, when I wrote my book, Fooled Again, was that the mainstream press ignored it, was not interested. No interviews, no reviews, nothing. That included NPR. But the left press attacked my book and also attacked Bobby Kennedy when he had some pieces in Rolling Stone that are first rate, two great articles in Rolling Stone. He and or I were attacked by Salon, Mother Jones, The Nation, which is thoroughly uninterested in and even hostile to discussions of this kind, and Russ Baker, TomPaine.com. Russ wrote a great, great book on the Bush family. But he did a piece saying that Ohio wasn't stolen in 2004. And it was evidence-free, his piece. We debated it twice, actually, on Pacifica. That changed the world. But the point is, what is that? I mean, what is that? That's just so weird. Because I'm not a Democrat, okay? And I don't see this as a partisan issue at all. And in fact, some people who've been really righteous on this issue are extremely conservative politically. Because obviously, if you can game an election, depending on who owns the machinery, everybody's at risk, and some people on the right get that. See, this is fundamental, not a leftist issue. Farhad Manjoo in Salon actually said that Bobby Kennedy and I represent the far left. He actually said that, like we're Shining Path gorillas, right? Like they believe in democracy, right? They're big on democracy, so.
No, I completely agree that just basic questions can be asked. You don't even have to, be as passionate as you are about it. But that people don't ask basic questions about, why don't we have audits of elections? I mean, that would go some distance to maybe, right, looking at these things again. I mean, why aren't elections audited? Why isn't election administration simplified? That's another way to gain some transparency. What is so hard about doing this? Election law is this massive matrix that tangles people up. And as much as these ID laws are targeting specific populations, another thing that they're doing, and this is, I think, part of the idea, it's understood, they will just mess things up on election day. They'll just be another reason why somebody turns around and walks away because 8 people in front of them, the guy doesn't have the right card, and they have to take him out of line, and they have to sign a paper, and you know, you're waiting, and you're waiting, and you're waiting, and it's just mess up the day stuff. You know, whether or not, in fact, nobody thinks they're going to have a huge impact just in terms of who doesn't have ID, because we know 90% or more of the population has driver's license. So, you know, when you ask in public opinion polls, it's a great issue. That reason why it's a great issue. You ask people, sounds reasonable. Sounds reasonable to ask people for an ID when they're voting, and the assumption is we don't know each other and so forth. Sounds reasonable. Why? Because I have ID. So how hard can it be? You know, and those people, how could there be people in the United States today who don't have the proper ID? And as I said, I interviewed one, who didn't. So part of it, too, is just you can ask basic questions about election administration. It doesn't mean you get put on one side of the political spectrum or the other. It's just a sort of curiosity about how this works and why are we doing it this way? This doesn't make sense. I say, and I get ridiculed, too, for this, you know, I sort of say, I think elections should be able to be run by, you know, fourth graders, basically, with some supervision, with, you know, nap breaks and so forth. But, you know, it shouldn't be as complicated as it is. And simplifying it and making it more transparent will go a long way to ferreting out certain kinds of problems and, you know, dealing directly with the issue of how we record votes, how we count them, how we aggregate them, how we look at them, and so forth. It's pretty straightforward in that way. So
right, absolutely. I mean, why shouldn't people just be registered automatically when they reach 18?
Right. You don't like civic groups going out registering people because you think they're just going to sign up, you know, immigrants or something who are not citizens. Well, then why don't you advocate for automatic registration? Figure it out. How difficult can this really be in this day and age?
Right.
So. You know, that it may be partly that election administration is just one of those issues the eyes glaze over, you know, who can't like focus on this, it's too boring, that it doesn't become a sort of rallying point, but that's because we really have separated it from the civic issues and the democracy issues that it should be connected to.
Right. Yeah.
We used to have civics in schools, and we don't have that anymore, and the other countries that you mentioned that gave up the machine, do they have civics in their schools? Or?
That I don't know.
I don't know if they teach civics per se, but I doubt that the populations in the Netherlands and Germany and Ireland are as depoliticized as Americans are.
Okay.
Americans are profoundly depoliticized, and it's because we live in a consumer culture, right?
Individualism.
So-called individualism, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think of part of the connection, because I teach young people, students in college, you know, part of the problem is that the voting act is an individual act. You do that by yourself. You're supposed to be alone in the voting booth. You make your decision in your mind, your heart, whatever. It's a very individual act. But the fact is, it really matters at the group level or the collective level or the aggregate level. That's when it matters. And so when where you've had a kind of democratic reform and movements, it's because people have identified with whatever group, you know, whether it's sort of workers' rights or the civil rights movement. They've been part of a movement, they've been part of a group, and they've used the ballot collectively to try to achieve something. So that disconnect between, well, voting is something I just do, I can't possibly matter, you know, how many million people live in this city or how many million live in the United States, how can one vote matter? That itself is a kind of depoliticizing. That's to say, the way we think about voting and the way we think about how we're connected to these democratic rituals, routines, and practices is really important. So changing people's understandings about the importance of voting is I think what you're touching on in terms of talking about civics being taught, you know, to young kids and not having that anymore.
Yeah, because also the parents don't take you there, or you don't watch programs like that with your parents. It's something that doesn't, it's not the schools and it's not the parents.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen.
Yeah, you've got to do this sort of abstract thing and think about yourself. You're just one little person. Why does it matter? You know, I'm busy today. I got to work. There's a long line. Why does it matter? How do you connect that to the massive ramifications, you know, of a sort of a, you know, a two-party system where I was at a teach-in today on debt and austerity and how people are fighting back. And the world-renowned economist Jeffrey Sachs said, we live in a country with two center-right parties. This is a mainstream economist who's come a long way, I think. When your choices aren't there, right? I mean, the system is problematic up and down. The electoral system, the voting system, and our political system, our representative system, is sort of problematic all over the place. Getting people to kind of understand how all these things are connected is really difficult. And I think you're absolutely right to point that out, that if that doesn't start early enough, you know, it's hard to get people to make those connections. It's understandable why people say, why should I vote? It's very understandable.
Right, and it relates to the fact that, you know, we are raised to kind of fetishize voting. We think that democracy is only voting, so that the extent of each of our own, you know, each person's participation is like every 2 years you go stand in line. Like, that's no.
Right.
Voting is only one way in which you participate in democracy. Protest is another. Mm-hmm. Lobbying is another. Lawsuits, that's another, right? Unions is another. Taxes, money, all of this, right? So the trick is both to emphasize, you know, at the same time to emphasize the crucial importance of voting and the consequences of being disenfranchised without, you know, bolstering the mistaken notion that that's the whole ball game.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. To be depoliticized is to think, okay, so I vote, right?
Yeah.
Why should I vote? Well, I will vote. I'll get out the vote. Even getting out the vote and being passionate about the vote and only the vote is a kind of depoliticization, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, sort of on one day, a year, or every 2 years.
That's right.
Doing something is not going to really cut the mustard, as they say.
Yeah.
I'm from England. I would think that you are politicians a bit to me to be so insensitive to this problem. You say that you're not polarized towards any particular party. But they, you know, you've got a system where you say there's two centre-right parties in the country. But surely they are in opposition to one another. And at times they must be, you know, concerned about it. They can't be so stupid as to simply ignore the problem.
Well, yeah, the question, a very good question is, you've got a political system with two parties, surely they compete. So the party that's getting screwed obviously must know what's going on and want to do something about it, or there's something wrong with them, like a brain cell deficit, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's a very complicated problem, and that's like the most important question that you've just posed, right? Now, one reason is that some Democrats, prominent ones, are in the pockets of these voting machine companies. Okay? It's just old-fashioned corruption. They don't want anybody talking about this stuff. And Rebecca Mercury, who's a leading authority on electronic voting, has, you know, argued that in some states, Democrats have stolen elections electronically, specifically New Jersey and Maryland, or so she the evidence leads her to suspect. It's you can't say it happens on both sides, because it happens a little bit on one side and a whole lot on the other. Still, that's enough. You're talking about key Democrats in Congress. That's enough to seal their lips. That's enough to make them not want to go there. Okay. Then there's the fact that with our two-party systems, different from a parliamentary system, you know, people basically have a lock on incumbency for the most part. See, I think there's 98% incumbency.
It's pretty high.
It's really high. So that means their nests are feathered, they're comfortable, okay? And I do think that where Democrats tend to be dumb, okay, is that they think, I'm just guessing now, they think that they have worked out a really tidy arrangement whereby they kind of share the spoils with the other side. That's their view. They don't understand the kind of ferocity and fanaticism of this Republican Party, which is not your grandfather's Republican Party. This is a Republican Party. It was taken over by the Christian Coalition starting in the early 90s. That's where the Christian Coalition went. It didn't just die and go to heaven, okay? It took over the Republican Party. The party is now the party of theocratic politics, so-called social issues, right? It's anti-abortion. It is apocalyptic. It is anti-environmental. It is way, way off the map. They think the Democrats are devils, okay? They think they should be burned at the stake. But Democrats are too comfortable and corrupt to really go there, you see? So you get a backroom politician like Barack Obama, disguised as a great progressive savior, or so he was. He's not gonna do anything about this. I'm from Chicago, okay? I speak about this with a little authority. This is a backroom guy who makes deals with whoever is powerful, as he did with like the pharmaceutical companies and the healthcare companies and so on. The last thing he's gonna do is look seriously at this, okay? These are partial explanations, okay? But the fact is, I think the question has to be asked and answered again and again and again till we get an adequate range of answers to it, because it is, on the face of it, ridiculous that they would put up with this.
Right? Okay, so generally, your population, are they ignorant of this problem as well?
How could the population not be ignorant of the problem? I will say, however, having spent years, literally, traveling the country and talking to groups like this, okay, and doing local media and so on, that more people than not suspect that this is happening, okay? It isn't like people are waddling around in perfect complacency thinking, you know, everything's great, votes are getting counted. No, people are deeply suspicious and concerned, okay? But it's like people thinking probably there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, you know, or thinking maybe the 9/11 Commission didn't answer every question. In other words, it's a suspicion. It's just a gut feeling. Until those suspicions are confirmed with solid information, it just makes people kind of uneasily apathetic. I mean, they think, well, I think this isn't working right. I think there's something wrong here. Or, you know I couldn't vote. I met many, many people who had that experience. You know, I tried to vote. The machine wouldn't let me vote. The machine changed my vote. They told me I wasn't registered when I was, because the registration is computerized too, you know. And it's the easiest thing in the world to just erase people from the rolls, okay? So the people who have been subjected to it know it, okay? And anybody who's used a computer can tell the computerized voting is problematic. But as long as it stays in the realm of mere suspicion, as long as people don't rush to confirm that suspicion and say, yeah, you're right, and here's why, it's unproductive. It doesn't really get people doing anything about it.
Okay, sorry, and finally, do you notice any apathy of the voting population, such as, well, it's not worth voting because it doesn't matter who's in, nothing's going to change?
But you want to answer
that? Run the stats. Of eligible voters, how many are registered, and of the registered, how many are eligible? Could that answer?
Right.
So the
question was about apathy and how this, you know, depoliticization Mark was talking about works, and how this sort of suspicion, cynicism, you know, sense that all politicians are corrupt, so the system must be corrupt. They hold their nose if they do vote. Yes, I mean, I think of people who are eligible to vote, registration rates are usually in the sort of 75% to 85% range of being registered, but then the turnout rates are much lower. So, for example, we think we had a really high turnout election in 2008. That election was 61% of the eligible population casting
ballots.
But
isn't the turnout rate based on the number of votes counted?
Yes. It's based on the number of votes counted.
It could be much higher than we think.
That's the reported rate.
Right.
So you've got, you know, approaching half the population that should be voting, is eligible to vote, meets the simple test of being a U.S. citizen, being of age, and so forth, not showing up in presidential elections. And, you know, here in a place like New York City, I mean, it only goes down the lower you go, so meaning state elections turnout is lower, city elections turnout is lower, and when you actually look at the number of people who elect the person who wins, it's a fraction of the population. And here's, I mean, it's another way in which people don't ask questions. They ask, how does this system how is this system working when the majority of the population is not being represented here? And we accept it as a democracy, right. and it's not in that sense.
I just want to emphasize this one point, and then we'll stop, because we have to. You know, the argument about voter apathy tends to be, it can be used as an anti-democratic argument, because you could say, well, people are too, you can't get off their fat asses and vote, so maybe they shouldn't have the vote. But again, the turnout rate is based on the number of recorded votes, okay? Now, let me recommend the research of a mathematician, statistician named Richard Charnin, C-H-A-R-N-I-N, very interesting stuff. He argues persuasively that Barack Obama did not win by 9.5 million votes. He argues that Barack Obama won by 23 million votes. Okay, now, if true, that doesn't mean just that Barack Obama won in a landslide, or would have. But what it also means is that maybe the turnout wasn't as low as we think. You know, maybe the thing that kills you about all this is that the official results are used to interpret all of reality, not only here but abroad. So, I mean, I can tell you from talking to people who've been in Iraq that when George W. Bush was reelected, that stiffened the resolve of the Iraqi insurgents to kill more American soldiers. Okay? I am persuaded and can argue convincingly and quickly that George W. Bush did not win in 2004. Like that had lethal consequences for some of our troops. But the fundamental point here is that this isn't only a civic issue, it's an epistemological issue. It has to do with how we know what we know. Who do we even think we are? Progressives have tended to think for years that they're outnumbered by all these, right-wingers. That's a fantasy. That's just a fantasy. You know, on issue after issue after issue, the American majority is pretty progressive, even though they hate the word progressive and they hate the word liberal. Okay, but you can go through the issues, and people are not conservative, So
they want the government to intervene in the economy, to regulate the economy.
They want
fairness.
The
they want to raise the minimum wage.
Want
they
social
want
social security.
The
they
safety
want to do
net.
Something about global warming. Yeah. And we're going on and on. Anyway, we I'm getting the high sign. Even though if I took a vote in here, people would ask that we continue. But thank you so much, Lori.
Thank you. Really thank great. You very much.
Get the book. Buy the book.